This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
In this episode of Storage Unpacked, Martin and I talk to Howard Marks from Vast Data. Yes, it's the Howard we all know and love from his independent days, now chief storyteller with Vast. This episode ran for about an hour, so we split it into two parts. You're listening to the first 30 minutes, where we cover the background to the technology, hardware, and data protection. Hi, this is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast this week with Martin. Hi, Martin.
Hey, Chris, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good, thanks. Just getting back into work after a little bit of a break. How about you? What are you up to?
Well, I had last week off for half term, and it looks like summer has arrived.
Yes, it certainly does. Weather certainly picked up, which is a great thing. Another great thing happens to be the fact that we have a guest this week.
Not Donald.
No. Oh, do you know what? Yeah, he's busy, I think. He's gone to meet the Queen or somebody. Somebody okay. Possibly not quite as important, but he's gone to meet somebody else anyway. So no, we don't have Donald with us.
Yeah, we have somebody better, though.
Instead, we do have an American.
I am an American, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're joined by Howard Marks, who is now from Vast Data. Hi, Howard.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
We're good. Oh, pretty, very good.
Pretty good. So, Howard, last time we spoke, you weren't working for Vast Data. In fact, you were independently working for yourself as deepstorage.net or deepstorage.net, depending on which profile we used to look you up. So what happened?
I decided that I was looking to join a team, and the Vast guys came around and had a great story to tell. So I joined up as the storyteller.
Fantastic. Now, Vast Data, as we'll get to in a second, is a startup. So you've joined them as that, as you said, storyteller. It's obviously a storage company. That's your background. Not sure whether there's anybody on this podcast who possibly doesn't know who you are. But how about that 10-second little background about who you are, just in case people don't know?
Sure. You know, I started in the industry writing device drivers for hard drives 40 years ago, but spent most of my career as an independent consultant, journalist, analyst. So you've seen me at PC Magazine and Network Computing and Network World pontificating about the storage world. And I decided to get back in it and actually make some stuff again.
So let's talk about Vast Data then, Howard. As a startup, it's a new company. What is the company about at a very high level, and what are they selling?
Well, the beginning of the company is our founders were involved from the very beginning in some of the all-flash arrays that people are using now. And when they went off to think about what they were going to do next, having already built all-flash arrays, they talked to the customers and discovered that very few people who have an all-flash array are looking for something faster. What people who have all-flash arrays want is an all-flash array they can afford to put the applications they can't afford to put on their current all-flash array on. So Vast is about building all-flash systems that are affordable like spinning disk systems. And as you might guess from the name, part of that affordability comes from scale. So we build systems that are vast and are scale out and go from petabytes to exabytes.
So that's an interesting background that you quote there from the founders of the company, in the sense that they went out and talked to people who already have platforms. Martin, you and I on this podcast many times have talked about the fact that we end up with a number of iterations that come along over time where we see the vendors that had traditional arrays producing technology that was going at one speed, but then we saw a real speed up of technology where people tried to take software out of the I/O path and really get down to very, very low latencies. As Howard says, that's clearly not a market that everybody is going to be able to put every single solution on, because it would just be too expensive to do it.
Yeah, we've talked about this a lot, haven't we? That we strive to sub-millisecond latencies isn't necessary for a lot of people. With people moving their processing off into the public cloud, for example, these people obviously don't need incredibly high-performance storage. So it's a small product. And we can go back to the days when we used to laugh about Violin. We used to say that performance wasn't a product. And I think this is what maybe Vast is beginning to address, that it's not all about performance.
Yeah, it's like a general applicability thing, isn't it, Howard?
Well, it is about performance, but it's about sufficient performance, not the absolute best performance. You know, once you have sub-millisecond latency, the difference between 600 microseconds of latency and 300 microseconds of latency is very small if your application is busy doing other things. So, you know, I wouldn't go to performance doesn't matter, but once you've reached that sub-millisecond latency, then it's much more important to be affordable and available and scalable than it is to be slightly faster. Now, don't get me wrong, there's always a market for the next fastest thing. Early on in my career, I built systems using head per track disks. So faster is better, but how much you're willing to pay for faster becomes an issue. And where VAST comes around, we're selling faster, but we're not selling faster for your Oracle database that's already on some all-flash array. We're selling faster for all the applications and all the data you've tiered off to spinning disk, because you may not be able to get full use of it from the spinning disk. You know, things like analytics require a certain amount of back-end performance. And if you spool your archive off to an object store, and then you want to do a full text search because you've got a subpoena, you may have to bring it all back from the object store to search it. If you had one storage system fast enough for your critical applications, scalable enough to go to exabytes, then all your data would be where it was accessible for that kind of deep learning.
Okay, so I guess framed that quite nicely, because what we're talking about is a platform that's bringing a much more accessible use of certain technologies, which I'm about to talk about in a second, to the marketplace, that allows you to, in general, deliver a higher level of performance to a wider range of your data than you possibly would be doing today.
Yeah, well, I mean, our goal is to kill off tiering. If we can be as cost-effective as what people are now using for their low-performance tier, why have a low-performance tier?
Killing off tiering might be I think, a challenge, in the sense that there'll always be stuff at the high end. But I would agree with you that consolidation at the lower end is without a doubt a very sensible, reasonable goal to be heading towards.
And there is some small market for the NVMe over Fabrics 120 microsecond high performance trading. We can monetize that. And we don't play in that market, and that's fine.
We're pretty clear where your technology is intending to sit. Now, let's talk about the actual componentry and the, if that's a real word, the components that have allowed you to deliver that. And I think looking at the way that the market's gone over the last, say, 18 months, 2 years, we've seen two technologies that have really come in that have allowed you to build a solution that can really address this. And the first one, which is something we've talked about a lot on this podcast and I've written a lot about, is QLC Flash. We'll come back to that in a second. And the second one is the use of what some people like to call persistent memory and others like to call storage class memory. But what we basically mean there is byte addressable persistent storage that potentially is sitting on the memory bus within a server. And I think without those two technologies, we would struggle to get where we are today. But those really form the component parts that build on your architecture. Is that fair to say?
Close. We use Optane SSDs, so it's not really persistent memory because it's not really byte addressable. We treat it as if it was byte addressable, but we're not using the Optane DIMMs. We're using the PCIe SSDs.
Okay, we can think of it in terms of the Optane side, but not necessarily the connectivity that's an NVDIMM style format.
Right. Our connectivity is NVMe over Fabrics. So the way we like to say it, there's three technologies that make our architecture possible. And when our founders were designing the system, all three were announced but not shipping yet. And so you weren't 100% sure that they would be ready when the product was ready. So we made a bet. And the first of those is QLC Flash, just to bring the cost of flash down. The second is 3D Crosspoint, so that we can have a persistent shared store that's accessible to all of our VAST servers, the software that acts as a controller and more in our architecture. So we have an HA enclosure that's connected via NVMe over Fabrics to a series of VAST servers. And the VAST server is a piece of software. It runs in a Docker container. Most of our customers so far have bought it from us as an appliance, but because it's a Docker container, we're flexible about that. The VAST server acts as the protocol endpoint. So when you access a VAST cluster via NFS or S3, or by the end of this year, SMB, you're talking to a VAST server, and it's a scale-out system. So you can have as many VAST servers as you need to provide the performance that you're looking for. The VAST servers talk via NVMe over Fabrics, over 100 megabit per second Ethernet, or InfiniBand, to the HA enclosure. The HA enclosure includes both Optane SSDs, so 3D XPoint, and QLC Flash. So the Optane SSDs are where we store the metadata. And so those VAST servers that are the front end that are talking to the users are stateless. They don't store metadata in DRAM. They don't store metadata in NVDIMMs with backup capacitors. All the state of the system is immediately written to the 3D XPoint. So if a VAST server dies, another VAST server assumes its virtual IP address. Your NFS or S3 or SMB client does a retry and reconnects, and you pick up right where you left off. And we're saved all the difficulty of keeping cache coherent between an arbitrary number of servers acting as protocol and management nodes. Every time a server wants to know something, there's a single source of truth, and that's the metadata in the Optane that's shared by all of these servers.
Okay, you dive straight into the depths of the technology there, Howard, which is great. But I'm going to step you back a little bit just so we can make sure people can build a visual picture of exactly what we've just been talking about. So from a physical layer in terms of storage, you've got HA servers, which are holding both QLC and the persistent memory, the Optane.
Server's a little bit strong of a term. It's okay. Really just a JBOF.
Right. Okay.
So the VAST servers, the ones that run our software, mount every SSD in every enclosure in the cluster when they power up, and they talk directly down to those SSDs.
Right. So we could even think of them as literally just shelves of devices, nothing more. No, yep. Intelligence, no CPU, no processor involved.
There are CPUs, but they run minimal code.
Right. Okay. So let's think of it in terms of that, just a bunch of flash devices sitting on the network. So there must be, I guess, some sort of backplane that allows those devices to be exposed to the network that you've got in place.
Yeah, well, the CPUs in that box really just connect between the InfiniBand and the Ethernet and the SSDs.
And the SSDs, yeah. So they do that sort of that interface piece. But after that, effectively, all of those devices are just exposed on the internal storage network. I'll call it that for now, because I would imagine a deployment would probably keep that separate. But the storage network that consists of all of those devices, and it could be one of those boxes, it could be 100 of those boxes.
Yes.
So I can scale out my storage physically to as much capacity as I like. But then in terms of how I access it, there's effectively a second layer, almost like a bit of a client-server type architecture, where my host, my server, it's actually accessing that storage directly, because actually you can see all of the NVMe devices on the entire network. Now that in itself is quite an unusual design in that sense, to make every device available.
Chris, I would tend to disagree with it's an unusual design. I actually think it's an evolutionary design. The way I can visualize this now, and that now way Howard's described it, and he'd probably hit me for this, it feels like what should have happened when NetApp tried to build their scale-out system. So your VAST servers are like your heads. They're stateless heads, but they're still like heads. The VAST enclosure is your disk shelves, and the NVMe switches in there are the internal fabric to what would be a traditional storage array. It feels like an evolution. It feels like a clever evolution, but from my point of view, it feels quite evolutionary.
Well, it's revolutionary because that back-end fabric didn't exist before NVMe over Fabrics, really. I mean, there were SAS switches, but I don't remember ever seeing them in a storage system where 8 controllers could connect to 22 shelves directly. SAS was almost always done in loops. And so one drive in a SAS shelf could only be talked to by two controllers because it had two ports.
Yeah, this is the thing. So you're moving away from the dual head, but actually if you were to draw the architecture in some ways, it would feel very familiar to somebody.
So most scale-out systems today are shared nothing, that each node has its own media and CPU, and they coordinate amongst themselves to build a storage system. Our model is shared everything. All the media in the system is shared by all the vast servers. And so no one has to be responsible for managing any particular device. That can all be parallelized and shared.
I think it's quite an interesting analogy to try and look at the two. And you just highlighted the idea of shared nothing and shared everything. It might be that in some scenarios, you might think shared everything was bad because you might have dependencies on devices that are connected to each other. But in terms of the way that your architecture is built, that shared everything actually doesn't actually create any dependencies in that sense.
No, because the NVMe over Fabric's fabric essentially makes it a mesh, that all of the media is equally accessible to all of the vast servers.
Whereas, Martin, if you look at the architecture you were thinking of, in certain respects, some of that dependency might be that some drives might be closely coupled with maybe at least one controller, and as a result, there would be some dependencies existing in the architecture somewhere. This effectively completely abstracts that and takes it away. So I guess in terms of what you mean by evolution, I can see how that isn't an evolution of the way things have gone.
Okay, so from my point of view, it looks very similar to how I would design and build a GPFS cluster, taking it back to what I do in a day job. So if I'm building a GPFS cluster where I have a number of scale-out front-end nodes, I know it's not identical, Howard, so don't get too upset. But then I'd have a fiber channel mesh. So all the servers would be talking to all the disk controllers, and that's how we'd build it. And then we'd have protocol nodes coming out the front, which would be part of the servers. So from my point of view, this does look very familiar. It feels architecturally familiar, comfortable. It may not be so familiar for people who haven't dealt with parallel file systems and how you build these. Talk about it being revolutionary. Apart from the NVMe switches, it doesn't feel revolutionary, which isn't a bad thing. It means that immediately, from an architectural point of view, I'm very comfortable with it.
And there are disadvantages to being too revolutionary, being something that customers understand in a 10-minute conversation, not a 3-hour conversation, is a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's why it was worth just re-emphasizing some of those hardware components, because immediately from my memory, I got one bit wrong, didn't I? The fact that you're not using SCM in an NVDIMM format, you're using it as an SSD format, because you need to be able to present those devices on the fabric just like you do with every other device.
Because they have to be shared, because we share everything.
Yeah, absolutely. It just shows you, even I'm forgetting the detail of what I've seen in the past as part of the discussion. So, exactly how you put these things together, it does help to go into that next level of detail.
Right.
But I'd like to just touch quickly on the persistent memory side again, because if we were doing what Martin was just saying, or we were building another type of design, we potentially would build out maybe controllers or some sort of control aspect within the architecture that managed the I/O at the front end that would somehow hold some metadata that described exactly what was going on in terms of I/O in progress, as well as the way that stuff was laid out on disk. And one of the classic issues with any, say, scale-out architecture or even just a dual controller architecture is somehow you have to keep that data coherent. Now, in your architecture, you're not having to do that because the server component is stateless, isn't it?
Right. So new data comes into a vast server. That vast server writes that data to multiple 3D crosspoint SSDs in one or more enclosures. And once that write transaction is complete, that data is coherent. It's stored and it's available to all the other vast servers immediately. So we don't have all that east-west coherence management traffic.
That's the bit I think I was just, the next stage I think that is important in understanding how this could scale, because without that, you can't scale the front-end server component, whether that's deployed as a piece of software or even if it's deployed as an appliance. It would be very hard to scale that across, let's say, tens or thousands of clients unless you would have somehow abstracted that away. It just wouldn't be possible.
Exactly.
Okay. So we've got an idea of the way that you've basically, I guess, disaggregated everything, and hence the reason the architecture is called DAES.
Disaggregated shared everything.
Which is exactly what we've already just said. Once we've done that, we've got an idea of physically how we're laying the data out, how we're using both SCM and then QLC storage. You didn't really sort of finish the discussion exactly as to exactly how the two pieces of the persistent storage are being used. You said everything gets written into the Optane layer, but then how does that get passed down to the QLC?
Here's the next big secret, right? So new data comes in and it gets written to the 3D crosspoint by the VAST server that's processing that transaction. Asynchronously, a VAST server collects up data from the crosspoint and destages it to the QLC flash. And we do a couple of extra special things on the way. So QLC is good because it's less expensive. Get 4 bits per cell, and the flash vendors charge us less for flash so we can be more cost effective. The problem with QLC is that the penalty for squeezing that extra bit in there is that you can overwrite that flash fewer times before it wears out. So we do lots of things in what we call a global flash translation layer to treat that QLC flash gently. So when a VAST server decides it's time to destage data from crosspoint to flash, first we reduce the data and we use a slightly different reduction method than everybody else. We use what we call global compression. Traditional data reduction uses two techniques: local compression, where you take a chunk of data and you compress it, and deduplication, where you identify two chunks of data that are identical and you only store one. The problem with that combination is if there are changes that are small but still make the block different, that block still gets saved. So a 1 byte difference on a system that's doing deduplication on 64K blocks means you're storing 64K, okay, reduced 40K of data. What we do is, like deduplication, we break data up into chunks, and then we use what we call a similarity hash. So we hash the chunk, not with a strong collision-resistant hash like SHA-1, but with a hash that generates the same hash value for chunks that contain similar data. And then we take multiple chunks that that hash to that same similarity value, and we compress them together. If you understand how data compression works, two chunks that generate the same similarity hash are going to compress with the same compression dictionary. So the delta, the difference between the first chunk we saw that generates that hash, that we call the reference chunk, and a new chunk that generates that hash, is typically very small. And then we store those delta chunks.
That's a very different method than traditional data compression and deduplication would be done. Very different. Now, is that done to save on I/O cycles? Because obviously all the work's being done by a server and that could be on the client. Or is it done to save space? Or is it done for a combination of both?
It's done for a combination of both. First of all, it gives us better reduction. And in fact, we're just introducing a guarantee program where we guarantee to reduce data better than anybody else.
Hurrah! We had a program on that a couple of weeks ago, so you could come top of the list in terms of people who were recommending their guarantee program.
I like that. Better than anybody else, because it means it takes some things out of the equation where you get data which isn't very compressible, so it actually becomes a bit more realistic.
The only fine print is that the data not be encrypted.
I don't think anybody would allow you to do that, would they, to be honest?
Encrypted data is very difficult to reduce, so nobody's going to reduce it well. You know, if your data isn't encrypted and you can demonstrate to us that somebody else's storage system compresses your data better, then we'll make good and make sure that you get the benefit of that better reduction. Mm-hmm. We don't think it's going to happen. So first of all, it gives us better reduction. Second of all of this data reduction happens before the data is written to flash. So the VAST server reads the data from the write buffer that's in 3D Crosspoint and compresses it and writes it back to 3D Crosspoint temporarily until it's built a whole stripe of data. And then it writes that whole stripe of data down to the QLC sequentially. if you look at how QLC SSDs work, you know, one vendor published on their spec sheet the endurance of this drive if you did 4K random writes and various mixtures of random and sequential writes till they got to 128K sequential writes. Writing large sequential blocks to that SSD, that vendor says you get 16 times the endurance than if you wrote 4K blocks.
And I don't know whether you're referring to Micron in that particular instance, but I've seen some data that Micron have published quite freely that shows how, depending on how you write to their QLC drives, you'll get much higher resilience. And they actually graph that up for you to show you that high block sequential writes are actually much more beneficial to their platform and therefore will give you higher endurance.
So we write very large stripes, substantially bigger than 128K. So we write large, substantial stripes. We get better endurance from the QLC SSD right there. Second, we write these stripes that are as big as the SSD's behavior tells us it erases things in. So today's QLC flash chips have erase blocks that are many megabytes in size. So if you send data smaller than that erase block and the amplification that's caused by the SSD controller, the SSD eventually has to do garbage collection. We write and manage all of our data in huge stripes that mean that the SSD doesn't have to do garbage collection more often than our log structured element store file system has to do garbage collection.
So Howard?
Yes.
Howard, if I can interrupt, this writing things sequentially and storing things is, have you not just reinvented Waffle?
Yes, it's a log-based file system, but Waffle is based on 4K chunks.
Yeah, you've invented Super Waffle. We're going to call it Super Waffle. That's what we're going to call it now, Howard.
I cannot endorse that name.
They've probably got a trademark on it anyway.
So, you know, compared to a typical log structured file system, there's a couple of differences. The first is that our units are just much larger. And the second is that all of our metadata is byte oriented, not block oriented. So in a file system like Waffle, a file extent has a pointer to a 4K block. In our file system, a file extent has a pointer to an LBA in an SSD to a particular byte and then a length so that we pack data tighter together and we don't have the problem with compressed data that you compressed 4K down to 1700 bytes, but you only have 4K blocks, so you have to store that 1700 bytes in 4K anyway.
Yeah, so it's super dense waffle. There you go. Super heavy, super dense waffle with extra cream. Sounds great.
Well, I like the extra cream part. So, you know, we write very carefully. We understand how the SSDs work. You know, we wear level across the entire system. So if you have a system with hundreds of SSDs, one application that's doing a huge amount of writes isn't going to wear out the SSDs that are in that RAID set because that write data is going to be spread across the whole pool. And then we use a new version of erasure coding called locally decodable codes that let us write very wide stripes with very high efficiency. On our smallest system, we use +4 erasure coding, so we can afford to have 4 device failures before data loss, but our overhead is still 10%. And as the system grows, the width of the stripe grows. A typical VAST system, we do 150+4 erasure coding. And that means that our overhead is down under 3%.
So it's fair to say that the intention, like we said at the very beginning of this discussion, is the reason the company's called VAST Data. The intention here is that this isn't going to be a system for somebody who wants to put in something for 100 or 200 or 300 terabytes. We're talking about tens or hundreds of petabyte deployment solutions, and it's designed specifically for that.
At a minimum, we started a couple of hundred terabytes, but most customer, you know, today we're selling into the data intensive applications, media and entertainment, hedge funds, oil and gas, those kinds of industries where they have a lot of data. So we're selling systems that are multiple petabytes.
Right. Just to summarize then, you're using a different style of data protection across all of the media, which is a form of erasure coding. you're writing the data to SCM, and or at least to Optane, before you then stripe it and then write it to the QLC to minimize the write amplification, which saves a huge amount of wear on the actual QLC itself, which obviously allows you to produce, or at least that allows you to have a product that has a lot longer lifetime than it would do in any other way. So what are you offering in terms of a guarantee on that QLC technology?
10 years.
10 years.
If you pay your maintenance for 10 years, we'll replace your SSDs for 10 years.
That's a nice offer. That's a nice guarantee. And that is guaranteed, is it?
It is. And we missed one more thing about the erasure codes. When I say erasure codes, I'm sure you guys, because I know you well, think Reed Solomon. And if you wrote, and you know, the math in Reed Solomon would allow 150 plus 4 coding. But when an SSD failed in a Reed Solomon stripe of 150 plus 4, to rebuild, you'd have to read 149 data stripes and the parity. Our locally erasable codes allow us to rebuild with only a quarter of the data stripes. So the rebuild has a lot lower impact on the system, so we can make our stripes wider and therefore be more efficient.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.